Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Presidents, a king and queen, a prince, a chancellor, and a handyman from Maine joined family and friends to celebrate the life of President George H.W. Bush Wednesday. The day began with a 21-gun salute and the song Hail to the Chief as Bush's flag-covered casket came down from the Capitol where he had lain in state. The vehicle carrying his casket passed by the White House, where Bush had served the country as its 41st president. At the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., President Donald Trump sat next to former presidents Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, and their wives. Across the aisle were Bush's son George W. Bush, the country's 43rd president, and the rest of the Bush family. Presidential historian John Meacham called Bush America's last great soldier statesman in the first of four eulogies. Meacham described how Bush was shot down over the Pacific Ocean as a 20-year-old Navy pilot. He reminded others of how the event shaped Bush's mission in life. Former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney praised Bush for his work as a leader. He credited Bush for working to end the Cold War, uniting Germany, leading an international coalition to free Kuwait from Iraq, and creating the North American Free Trade Agreement. He added, "I believe it will be said that no occupant of the Oval Office was more courageous, more principled, and more honorable than George Herbert Walker Bush." Another family friend, former Senator Alan Simpson, brought laughter to the full cathedral with his story of loyalty and friendship. George W. Bush remembered his father as the brightest of a thousand points of light. He said his father was someone who made his children believe anything was possible. In a lighter moment, Bush said, "To us, he was close to perfect, but not totally perfect. The man couldn't stomach vegetables, especially broccoli." The late president was known for his dislike of the vegetable. The sun broke down at the end of his eulogy while talking about the time his parents lost a young daughter. He added, "Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again." The kinder and gentler tone of the state funeral had been set much earlier. The Bush family invited President Donald Trump to attend the event. Trump was not invited to Barbara Bush's funeral in April or the recent funeral of Senator John McCain. Earlier in the day, the president tweeted, "This is not a funeral. This is a day of celebration for a great man who has led a long and distinguished life. He will be missed. At the end of the state funeral, Bush's casket returned to Houston to lie in repose at St. Martin's Episcopal Church. On Thursday, Bush will be buried on the grounds of his presidential library at Texas A&M University. There, he will be buried next to his wife, Barbara Bush, and his daughter, Robin. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
This is What's Trending Today. Cold, snowy weather has arrived in many places. That means young people are enjoying building snowmen, going sledding, and having snowball fights. But in one small American city, snowball fights are illegal. Welcome to Severance, Colorado. The town, north of Denver, gets about 100 centimeters of snowfall a year. For almost 100 years, city rules have said it is illegal to throw or shoot stones or missiles at people, animals, buildings, trees, property, or vehicles. Snowballs were considered to be part of the town's definition of missiles. Kyle Reitkirk works for the town of Severance. He said children cannot believe that it is illegal to have snowball fights in their hometown. He said town leaders have for years told the children, "You have the power. You can change the law." But no one had tried until now. 9-year-old Dane Best lives in Severance with his parents and little brother. He has made it his mission to get the snowball fight ban overturned. Dane says he believes the law is outdated. "I want to be able to throw a snowball without getting in trouble," he said. Dane's mother, Brooke Best, told the Greeley Tribune newspaper that her son found out it was illegal to throw snowballs within town limits about a month and a half ago. Since then, he has been talking about how to change that. Dane wrote letters with his classmates in support of overturning the ban. And on Monday, he spoke about the issue at a Severance town meeting. Leaders listened as Dane presented his arguments. Then they all voted to lift the ban. Dane says the first person he hopes to hit with a snowball is his 4-year-old brother. Dane and his family have researched other Severance rules, including one that defines pets only as cats and dogs. Dane has a guinea pig, which appears to be illegal in Severance, too. And that's What's Trending Today.
A United States airport has become the first in the nation to permit passengers to use facial recognition technology to get on flights. The system launched last week at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport in the state of Georgia. The technology can be used by international passengers traveling through a special terminal. Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport usually ranks as the world's busiest airport based on the number of passengers. The terminal is operated by Delta Airlines, but it also serves passengers flying on international carriers Aeromexico, Air France, KLM, and Virgin Atlantic Airways. Delta said in a statement, it is the first fully biometric airport terminal to operate in the U.S. The goal of the system is to simplify and speed up the process of presenting documents to get on a flight. The company says passengers can begin using the facial recognition system when they first arrive at the airport. After the first check-in, passengers can also use face recognition to pass through security and to get on the plane. Delta says the system prevents the need for travelers to present their passport up to 4 times during the usual check-in process. Travelers look into a camera that scans their face. This image is then compared against a collection of pictures kept by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The agency collects face scans from passports and visas. The system, however, has raised concerns about privacy. Earlier this year, 2 U.S. lawmakers sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security, which is home to the Border Protection Agency. Senators Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Mike Lee of Utah urged that official rules be put in place before the program is expanded. Official rules, the senators said, would help Americans understand and accept the program. Jeremy Scott is a lawyer with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He has called the use of facial recognition at U.S. airports a massive threat. Scott placed a statement on Twitter. He said his fear is that the government's facial recognition database of citizens could be used for other purposes without an individual's permission. The government now has the power to identify you whenever it wants, without your consent, and even without your knowledge, he said. Scott added that through facial recognition, the government has created a digital ID of millions of Americans. He added, and they did this without a public discussion or consent, taking photos collected for one purpose and using it for another. John Wagner is Deputy Executive Assistant Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. He told CBS News any U.S. citizen who has privacy concerns can choose not to take part in the facial recognition system. He said this would prevent the airline from collecting a face scan to compare with CBP records. The CBP says its policy is to remove photos of U.S. citizens from its system once their identities have been confirmed. Delta says about 2% of passengers using the Atlanta Airport terminal have chosen not to use the facial recognition system. Next year, the airline plans to expand its biometric system for international travelers at Detroit Metropolitan Airport in Michigan. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared its independence from Britain on July 4, 1776. At first, the new nation was a loosely formed alliance governed under the Articles of Confederation. As we described in previous programs, all this changed when a new plan of government, the Constitution, went into effect on March 4, 1789. There was much to be done to make it work. The machinery of government was untested. Strong leadership was needed, and Washington was the man chosen to provide it. Many historians believe there would never have been a United States without George Washington. He led the American people to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. He kept the new nation united in the dangerous first years. Dorothy Moss is the assistant curator of painting and sculpture at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery in Washington. She says the painting, known as the Lansdowne Portrait, shows the way many people thought of Washington. It was painted in 1796 as Washington was finishing his presidency. In it, he is standing with one arm extended as if he is speaking to a large group of people. His hair is gray, and he is beginning to go bald. The former general wears formal clothes, but not the uniform of a soldier. Washington was tall but thin. In the portrait, he looks bigger than he was in real life. Curator Dorothy Moss says, in some ways, the portrait shows Washington like a king. But in other ways, she says, he appears like a neighbor or someone you could talk to.
He's shown with a serious expression, a determined look. People at the time commented on his broad jaw, which actually looks that way because he was wearing false teeth. His mouth is clenched, yet he projects a gentle spirit.
During his lifetime, Washington was honored for his courage and wisdom. After his death in 1799, he became almost godlike in the way people respected him. Dorothy Moss says even people in England thought there was something unusually special about George Washington. The British owner of the Lansdowne portrait kept the painting of the American president in his house.
The Marquis of Lansdowne commented that the visitors to his house would stop in reverence to it when they would pass by, that people were stopped in their tracks by it.
And in the United States?
The same reaction.
George Washington represented the spirit of America, what was best about the country. For well over 100 years, Americans found it difficult to criticize him. Modern historians, however, have painted a more realistic picture of Washington. They write about his weaknesses as well as his strengths. Yet this has not reduced his greatness and importance in the making of the nation. The force of Washington's personality and his influence was extremely important at the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution. Some say the convention would not have been held had he not agreed to attend. Later, as the first president, he gave the nation a good start. Washington was able to control political disputes in the new government. He would not let them damage the nation's unity. Washington often thought of the future. He wanted the first government to take the right steps. Some things may not seem important in the beginning, he said, but later they may have bad, permanent results. It would be better, he felt, to start his administration right than to try to correct mistakes later when it might be too late. He hoped to act in such a way that future presidents could continue to build on what he began. Washington had clear, firm ideas about what was right and what was wrong. He loved justice. He also loved the Republican form of government. Some people had difficulty seeing this part of the man. Washington looked like an aristocrat, and at times he seemed to act like one. He attended many ceremonies. He often rode through the streets in a carriage pulled by six horses. His critics called him king. Washington opposed rule by kings and dictators. He was shocked that some people talked of having a monarchy in America. He was even more shocked that they did not understand the harm they were doing. Washington warned that this loose talk could lead to an attempt to establish a monarchy in the United States. A monarchy, he said, would be a great victory for the enemies of the United States. It would prove that Americans could not govern themselves. As president, Washington decided to do everything in his power to prevent the country from ever being ruled by a king or dictator. He wanted the people to have as much self-government as possible. Such a government, Washington felt, meant a life of personal freedom and equal justice for the people. The 18th century has been described as an age of reason and enlightenment. Washington was a man of his times. He said, "No one could feel a greater interest in the happiness of mankind than he did." He said it was his greatest hope that the policies of that time would bring to everyone those blessings which should be theirs. Washington was especially happy and proud that the United States would protect people against oppression for their religious beliefs. He did not care which God people worshiped. He felt that religious freedom was a right of every person. "Good men," he said, "are found all over the world. They can be followers of any religion or no religion at all." Washington's feelings about racial oppression were as strong as his feelings about religious oppression. Like others of his time, he owned African slaves. But he expressed a hatred of slavery. "There was not a man alive," he said, "who wished more truly than he did to see an end to slavery. By his order, all his slaves were freed when he died." From the beginning, George Washington was careful to establish a good working relationship with the Congress. He did not attempt to take away any powers given to the Congress by the Constitution. By his actions, he confirmed the separation of powers of the three branches of the government as described in the Constitution. The Congress, too, was ready to cooperate. It did not attempt to take away any powers given to the president by the Constitution. The Congress, for example, agreed that President Washington had the right to appoint members of his administration, but Congress had the right to approve them. Washington asked some of the nation's wisest and most able men to serve in the new government. For Secretary of State, he chose Thomas Jefferson. At the time, Jefferson was America's representative to France. While Congress was considering Jefferson's nomination, Washington had heard of threatening events in France. He learned that a mob had captured the old prison called the Bastille. Washington was worried. The United States had depended on France for help during its war for independence, and it still needed French help. A crisis in France could be bad for America. The information Jefferson brought home would prove valuable if the situation in France got worse. Washington also thought Jefferson's advice would be useful in general, not just on French developments. For Secretary of the Treasury, Washington chose Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as one of Washington's aides during the Revolutionary War. For Chief Justice of the United States, he chose John Jay. Jay helped write the Federalist Papers. These are considered the best explanation of the Constitution ever written. Two delegates to the Constitutional Convention were named Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, James Wilson and John Rutledge. For Attorney General, Washington wanted a good lawyer and someone who supported the Constitution. The Attorney General is the nation's top law enforcement official. For that job, Washington chose Edmund Randolph of Virginia. It was Randolph who proposed the Virginia Plan to the Philadelphia Convention. The plan became the basis for the Constitution. Randolph refused to sign the Constitution because he did not believe it could be approved. But later, he worked to help win Virginia's approval of the Constitution. President Washington nominated his cabinet members, and the Congress approved them. The president was ready to begin work on the nation's urgent problems. And there were many. One problem was Spain's control of the lower part of the Mississippi River. American farmers needed to use the river to transport their crops to market. But the Spanish governor in Louisiana closed the Mississippi to American boats. There also were problems with Britain. The United States had no commercial treaty with Britain, and Britain had sent no representative to the new American government. Equally urgent were the new nation's economic problems. Two major issues had to be settled. One was repayment of loans made to support the American army during the Revolution. The other was the creation of a national financial system. Both issues needed quick action. Finding solutions to these issues would be the job of President Washington's Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.